Welcome to the Canadian Physiotherapy Association Pain Science Division PainCast. My name is Judy Hunter. I have a faculty position at University of Toronto, and I'm also curriculum director of the Certificate in Pain Management at the University of Alberta. I'm a PainCast committee member and will be moderating today's discussion. This episode is part of a 2015-16 series that I am conducting specific to the role of exercise in chronic musculoskeletal pain and as part of understanding the complexities of chronic pain. The first was with Dr. Sluka, where we looked at the physiological impact of exercise on the immune system, the nervous system, plasticity, and pain. And today we're focused on the clinical application, that is, exercise as a pain management tool within a biopsychosocial rehab approach to complex pain. I'm so pleased to welcome today's participant, Peter O'Sullivan. Dr. O'Sullivan's a specialist musculoskeletal physiotherapist, as awarded by the Australian College of Physiotherapists in 2005. And he consults 3 days a week in a multidisciplinary practice, and that's Body Logic. And he's a professor of musculoskeletal physiotherapy at Curtin University in Western Australia, where he teaches postgraduate physiotherapy and he conducts clinical research, and he's published many articles that many of you, I'm sure, have read. But today we're going to focus on an approach to chronic pain that Peter has termed cognitive functional therapy. So, welcome, Peter. I heard about your work, and welcome today so we can talk about it.
Thanks very much.
Your approach is challenging many of the existing beliefs in the health industry. Can you tell me how it all developed, how it all came about?
Yeah, it's probably something that's evolved over time. And I reflect back in terms of my basic training, where my understanding of pain was very much around structure, biomechanics, tissue stress. You know, it was a very peripheral kind of perspective on pain. And with my work, we're dealing with people with disabling and persistent pain disorders. We realized that model of understanding pain was just not sufficient. And this massive increase in knowledge in terms of understanding neuroscience and the role of the mind, emotions, cognitions in terms of driving pain and the behaviors of pain really forced us to rethink and broaden our understanding of looking at the role of the physiotherapist in managing pain. And so when we start looking at movement or physical activity, we see it much more as a behavior. And that a person with pain will behave in a certain way if they're threatened or frightened or distressed. And that is often manifest in the way they hold themselves, the way they posture themselves, the way they move, the activities they're frightened of, the things they avoid. And so we see, you know, as physiotherapists, we see these behaviors. And often, historically, we've interpreted them as something wrong with the structure. But now we see them much more in terms of this is something about the person's perception of their body and their thoughts and emotions that relate to that. And that's all tied up with their sensory experience of pain and what that means to them. And so that kind of evolution has forced us to change our way of looking at understanding pain and also the way we manage it.
So you're saying how they see themselves moving is almost how they understand their pain?
So there's growing evidence that the more distressed a human being is, the more frightened they are, the negative thoughts that they have about pain or the meaning of pain or the threat that that has on their life will impact on their experience of pain when they move and also the way they move. And so there's growing evidence that the more fearful and distressed the person is, the more pain they feel when they move, the more disabled they are. It will change their sensory responses to movement. Pain will ramp up more rapidly. And also it changes their behaviors around movement in terms of holding more protective muscle guarding when they move. You might move slower. You start, you know, breath holding when you move. And these are a reflection of someone's thoughts and and stress response in terms of the threat of movement. And they're things that become great opportunities to target in a therapeutic setting. And are often huge barriers for getting people to be active. So we know physical activity is one of the most effective ways of managing pain, but we realize that pain is often a massive barrier for people getting physically active. And so people get caught, we see this, where people get caught in a vicious cycle of fearing movement, and so they develop these protective guarded strategies when they move, so that when they move they hurt, and that reinforces the fact that movement's bad. And so that kind of trap that people get stuck in prevents them from experiencing the benefit of being active. And so that's where our approach really focuses on both the thoughts and emotional factors around feared movements, but also the behavior that people adopt when they move. And so our research has identified that actually people adopt behaviors when they do a feared task that actually in themselves become provocative. So it becomes a mechanism for self aggravation.
And further to that point in your model, it starts at the top of the model that I recently read. It said it starts with the fact that you feel the therapeutic relationship is key. Can you tell me what you mean when you say that?
Yeah. So if you have someone who's frightened to move, and you're going to take them back into that feared activity, and you're going to teach them to relax their body as they go back into that activity, unless they trust you, they won't do it. And so therapeutic alliance is that ability to listen to the story, extract the key components, to have that trusting relationship with the people willing actually tell you what's going on in their heads, their beliefs, their deepest fears, both in terms of movement and their pain, in terms of the future. And you can't extract that information unless you have a strong relationship, unless you're trusted. And then to take people confidently back into things that threaten them is in itself a very frightening journey for people who become disabled with pain. You can't do that unless the person trusts you, unless they realize that you have empathy, unless they realize that you acknowledge their situation and their level of suffering, and don't buy into the behavior. And I see a really big difference between I don't fear the pain, I respecting the pain, but not the behaviors that are associated with pain, which becomes so unhelpful. And I think that's central to this approach. You can't get people to do scary stuff unless they trust you.
So how can you summarize the four components then of the cognitive functional therapy?
Yeah, so we would say that if you take an example of someone who has a pain disorder where they think they're broken or damaged or pain is really threatening them, and often, and we found this in a lot of our research, of people who are frightened, they're thinking bad stuff. They're thinking they're damaged, and often that's fed to them by MRI results or someone telling them their pelvis is out, or someone saying, you know, you've got a weak core, you've got to protect your back, and that can often reinforce really unhelpful behaviors that can spin off in terms of creating a whole lot of disability in that person's life. So the first thing we do is to in a personalized way, based on the story that the person has told us, considering all the dimensions that are important in that story, is to try and help the person make sense of their pain. And that is around personalized education. So that is about reframing what's happening to that person in an evidence-based way, that actually very rarely does pain equal damage. That pain is much more likely to be because the system is sensitized, the person becomes frightened, they become highly protective and guarded, and that becomes a driver of their pain. So first making sense is really important. The second part, which we think is such a powerful inroad to changing pain behavior, is what we call developing experiential learning around someone's behavior. So if we take the example of someone who's frightened of bending, and when they go to bend, they anticipate it will hurt, they tense their body as they move, and that creates pain, which makes them think they shouldn't do it. So we would take them through a process of actually teaching them to relax their body, teach them to relax their back in a non-threatening way, So it's like exposure with control. And we take them through a process, reassuring that they're not going to do harm, relaxing their body, learning to move again in a way that is relaxed and not protective, and then take them back into that very thing they thought was going to do them harm. And usually it doesn't hurt. And so the experience, those behavioral experiments, massively challenge their beliefs. And so we use these functional behavioral experiments as powerful behavioral learning strategies that then, without us telling them not to be frightened, show them that actually to do something in a different way and with a different thought can actually dismantle that whole pain protective behavior. And so that experiential learning is part of our movement training part. And then that is taken back into feared activities and postures and social settings or work environments. So the person is directed to practice those movements in their daily life. And so that's where we start to generalize that training to have an impact in terms of their levels of disability. And then that provides an opportunity to address lifestyle factors. So once they have developed these normalization of these behaviors, then to get them active and then to address issues around their sleep and other lifestyle factors. But often what you see is that you can't get people to be active because their thoughts and behaviors set them up for failure with activity. And often we see that massive gap between what you want to get someone to do and these barriers in between. And that CFT model helps break those barriers to then allow people to get back to doing the things they want to do. So those key things around making sense of pain, understanding what they're dealing with, developing pain control, so it's feeling that they are in control of their pain and their body, and then back into valued activities is the kind of key steps that we think underpin that journey.
So this is different than core stability, isn't it? How can you explain the difference between?
Yeah, the whole premise behind core stability is that there's something wrong with your back. Your back's unstable. You need to protect it. That's the whole premise that goes behind that. So that is not an evidence-based view of the spine. In fact, what we see with people who are frightened is they use more core stability. They co-contract more. So they'll hold themselves, they brace themselves, they brace their abdominal wall and their back muscles, they stiffen themselves as they go to move. So core stability can drive a belief that the back is vulnerable and you need to protect it. Where our approach would be to say the back is resilient. We don't want you thinking of your back when you move. It's not normal. We want you to build the confidence to trust your body to move and focus on the things of daily living that give you life value, not to be thinking about how you hold your back. And I think we've seen this, and that's been a big part of my journey, is realizing that actually that whole model can actually reinforce the behaviors that people already have. It can reinforce vigilance, and it can reinforce that sense that actually the back is a vulnerable structure that needs to be protected. So I think, you know, if we look at the evidence base around that practice, it doesn't really fit now with our contemporary understanding of pain.
And leading to that, you have this clinical reasoning framework that is quite elaborate, and I read in 2005 you published a classification system, but since that you've developed your own system and you now have this clinical reasoning framework that is very interesting, and you describe it as sort of the multidimensional intervention that directs at these modifiable drivers.
That's right.
And I wonder if you can take us through that clinical reasoning and how it's changed since 2005.
Yeah. Sorry. look, this whole area is massively evolving because we're involved in lots of research as other research groups. And so as our understanding and knowledge increases, we have to integrate that into our practice. And that's necessitated a change and a shift. And I think what that framework does is it acknowledges that there are many factors that can influence someone's experience of pain and their levels of disability. And these can be things around their cognitions, their emotions, their social situation, their lifestyle factors, their movement behaviors, mix up with other health comorbidities, and also nervous system factors that can interplay with those things. Now, at the end of the day, if they, with any human being, usually there's not just one driver, there are multiple drivers. And so we would say that you need interventions that can target multiple factors effectively to help break those pain cycles, or those the cycle of pain and disability that people get into. And so it's like a clinical reasoning approach where you're forced to consider all of those factors for an individual and acknowledging that there'll be a different contribution or balance of factors for every person. So for one person, it may be that they're under enormous social stress, and so the social factors are very dominant. For another person, it may be they've been told that their back is, you know, is they've got a degenerate disc, and that they're going to get worse as they get older. So they develop a whole lot of fear around movement because they think their back's damaged. It may be because pain for that person is frightening and they have no strategy to control it. Or it may be because the person's highly sedentary, they're not moving and they're deconditioned. So every time they go to do something, they put abnormal stress on their system. So what the system does is allows you to go through that checklist and to consider the factors that are dominant and relevant for that person and then target them in a personalized way for that person. And I think we've kind of moved away from the word classification because it presumes you can box people. And what we realize is that every human being is an individual. And the cluster of factors are unique for that person. And we need a flexible framework that forces us as therapists to consider all the domains and just stop focusing on structure and biomechanics, because it's not really got us where we need to go. But it forces us to consider all of those dimensions as they're relevant for that individual and then develop strategies to target them. Now, it may well be that if those social factors and the psychological factors are really dominant, you need to work in tandem with other healthcare providers, such as a clinical psychologist. It may be that if the pain features are really dominant, you need to work with a pain physician in terms of addressing some of those central drivers of pain. But it allows that flexibility to see the role of the therapist and then to pull in other disciplines based on the dominance of those factors for the individual. And I think it creates a lot of freedom. Instead of constraining us to boxes, it creates a freedom in practice that actually is quite liberating. So I hope that makes that clear.
That does. So can you describe your own practice then? You talked about working with other professions. Can you describe?
So we work very closely with, within our practice, we see a whole spectrum of pain disorders. And I think one of your questions was, do I just treat back pain? No, of course not. So we see this as a model for pain, musculoskeletal pain, not just for back pain. We see people with TMJ pain, headaches, neck pain, shoulder, hip, knee, pelvic pain, thoracic pain, foot, knee. You know, the model fits for any pain problem, and we would use this approach to considering any pain disorder, musculoskeletal pain disorder. And within that model, as I said, we have networks of people we're linked to where we can work in tandem if it's needed. But in saying that, I think physiotherapists historically have had this huge fear of considering that they're dealing with psychosocial problems, and yet pain is distressing. So if you're dealing with pain, you're forced to deal with distress. And we have a huge number of skills that can help reduce pain-related distress and fear. Basic things around reassurance, education, facilitation, teaching people strategies to get back to doing the things they value, giving them lifestyle advice, all of those factors can have a massive impact on reducing people's levels of distress. And we forget that they're right in our toolkit. There is clearly a group where we need to refer and cross-refer and work with others. But there's a whole group of people who I think we miss opportunities for. So within our practice, we see a spectrum of people. We go through a process, we screen everybody when they come in the door. We use the Ouroboros screening tool, which is a very short, multi-dimensional screening tool. But we don't just rely on that. We heavily rely on the interview and the physical examination. as part of that process of course, triage, make sure you're not dealing with something serious, which you would refer through, but also then looking at the complexity of that person and whether the skill set of the therapist is sufficient for that problem.
And further to that, when you're goal setting then with the patient and working through short-term goals, can you give examples of what your earlier short-term goals would be?
So a lot of short-term goals, I mean, goals are really interesting because some people come to us with a goal to say, you know, a guy yesterday who's a highly anxious man whose goal is to work again and he wants to work and to drive a car. They're his goals. And so the inability to drive a car has massively socially isolated him because he's frightened, and he's frightened of putting his foot on the clutch. And yet he can do a heel race with his whole body weight. He can jog on the spot, but he can't put his foot on the clutch because he's had this memory of pain when he put his foot on the clutch many years ago. And so he's caught in this loop where he anticipates pain. So we set him up with a plan to replicate a clutch with some TheraBand, and he's going to put his foot down on that TheraBand until his foot absolutely fatigues. And then he's got to expose himself to getting in the car without driving, where he's putting the foot on that clutch. And then he then has to build up exposing himself to driving again. His other goal is to walk across the road as someone who walked kids across the road. And he's frightened of doing that. Even though he can play in the park with his kids, the thought of standing terrifies him. And so we've developed the strategy of building up his exposure to standing. And we can put music on when he's standing so it distracts him. So the goals may be functional goals. For others, it's pain control. Pain terrifies people, some people. And so we will develop strategies around them developing controllability, and often that's controlling their stress response to pain. And so they anticipate pain, they go into a fight-flight response, and it floods the system with adrenaline, they get pain. So we would control their breathing pattern as they do that threatened task. So these are really behavioral experiments around the sense of threat. So if you look at a long-term goal, it might be to drive a car, we would break that down into sequences and to build it back into the thing that the person doesn't do or can't, perceives they can't do. And the nature of fear is completely illogical. You know, we have people who can go for a walk, lift their children, but they won't sit in the chair. And you go, the relative threat to the body structurally of sitting in a chair is zero versus lifting a child. But the person's perception is that's threatening because they had a terrible experience sitting in a chair in an office where they couldn't get up and they had horrible levels, you know, very distressing levels of pain. And so that becomes the target of their anxiety. So they become our targets. So, in terms of what we target the things people say they can't do, that disable them or that frighten them.
That's fascinating, Peter, and so invigorating, and that's so much so that our time is up already. And I your work is revolutionizing the approach of PT, and I really appreciate it. You're empowering people to trust their body, you're working to normalize movement, develop positive beliefs, and the link between research and practice is so strong. I wish you every success.
Thank you for the opportunity to talking to your people and yourself.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure.